Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. When most people think about California wine, they think about Napa, Sonoma, maybe a great bottle they had on vacation. But we don't often think about the deeper history behind the glass, the history of labor, land, race, and power that made the industry possible. In this episode, I sit down with historian Dr. Julia Ornelas Hignan. In this episode, I sit down with Dr. Julia Ornelas Hignan, and her work really changed how I think about agriculture in the Central Valley and in California more broadly. Her book, The Grapes of Conquest, illustrates how farming Her book, Grapes of Conquest, is the subject of today's discussion. We talk about how early writers promoted farming as a kind of second gold rush, how the Great Depression shifted attention to labor conditions, and how scholars have increasingly reframed agriculture as an industrial system shaped by inequality and conflict. We also get into incredible stories of the agricultural society's role in professionalizing farming, the origins of the Anaheim wine colony, and the surprising diversity of people who actually built this industry. This is one of those expanding conversations that will give you a broader sense of California agriculture and wine, and viticulture specifically. Let's go meet Dr. Julia Ornelas Hignan. So, Dr. Ornelas Hignan, what are the origins of your interest in agriculture?
So, the origins of my research interests are very personal. My grandfathers were both braceros in the 50s. Really, great-grandfather was a bracero earlier than that. But I grew up in a family of storytellers. And I grew up hearing my grandfathers, great-uncles talk about their experiences coming to the States as temporary farm workers, as braceros of the 50s, their experiences following the crops. And that always fascinated me. So as an undergraduate, I had never really studied any history that related to my family until I got to Pomona College. And as an undergraduate, I remember a dear professor of mine, Helena Wall, who recently passed away, handing me a copy of Matt Garcia's A World of Its Own. And this is a book, it's about 20 years old now, that looks at citrus history in the Inland Empire in Claremont, California, Pomona.
What's that book called? I think I know it.
A World of Its Own.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm familiar.
Make sure I got that right. But so he talks about citrus history. Yeah, Matt Garcia's It's a World of Its Own in that area. But he focused on laborers and their families and their communities living in segregated neighborhoods in Claremont, California. And it blew my mind because in that book, I saw my own family's history reflected. So as a graduate student, I knew I wanted to write about agriculture in some form. I didn't know what. I really thought I would do a 20th century history, but serendipity took me elsewhere to wine in the 19th century.
Yeah. Let me ask you, because we're going to talk about the historical, the sociological, but I want to start with kind of the more mechanical. What was your kind of educational journey in understanding the world of agriculture just as like an industry or a system versus we're going to talk about broader historical and sociological? I'm just curious about the mechanics of that for you. How did you approach learning about agriculture broadly?
I think that as a graduate student, this is really when my focus shifted to formal study of agriculture and labor and the industry. As a graduate student, I took a readings course on the history of the American West. I took that with Bill Devereaux. It was a fun class.
Oh, yeah. I love him.
Yeah,
he's been a lot of fun.
He's been a wonderful mentor.
Previous guest on the show, and that was a conversation.
His work is phenomenal. He's just a generous human, too. And we spent a lot of time reading about land use in the American West. And that was a moment for me where I looked at this industry with a really critical eye. And I spent a lot of time reading about citrus. Orange Empire was a book that I wrote an essay, a historiographic essay, again, 20 years ago.
Yes.
And I realized that farming, agriculture was something that historians were looking at as an industry akin to steel production or factory work. And this is not new, right? This is not new. This is something that Carey McWilliams posited back in the 1940s. But as a young graduate student, it was new to me.
Yeah.
So I read all of this and I was fascinated by power dynamics, the relationship between big ag and local governments, state government, the federal government. I was absolutely intrigued by all of the financial support that big ag has gotten over the centuries. And I was interested in how they related to conversations over their workers, who are by and large, historically, in the case of California, have been immigrant people of color who have been racialized outside the body politic, have been excluded from citizenship. And all of those themes fascinated me.
Yeah. I want to ask you last question about background stuff before we jump into historiographic questions. I remember when I was a young undergraduate in history, and I had a graduate student make this, not a slight, but talk about Americanists, which is just the fancy way of saying someone that's interested in the history of the United States, and he was a medievalist or something. And that was the first time I learned about status within disciplines in the academy. How is research on agricultural history viewed within the academy? What is its status, would you say, amongst your colleagues and in the system more broadly?
Gosh, that's a hard question for me to answer, because I'm a woman of color who studies United States history, and I already feel a little bit marginalized within the academy. So I think I've learned to not take those things too seriously.
Okay.
As a person of color who works at a comprehensive university, I'm a faculty at the CSU. I already feel a little bit marginalized. I'm not a Research One faculty member, and I pay attention to those power dynamics. I'm aware that as a tenured faculty member, I'm straddling that line from between extreme privilege. So I tend to, I put my head down and I do my work. Intellectual inquiry and curiosity.
Yeah, I was asking for a specific reason. Let me go ahead and unpack the assumption behind the question. Because the assumption is if there are certain disciplines that, or areas of focus that have higher status, we're going to get less knowledge production in those areas that have less status. And so that results in lacunae all over the place in terms of how we understand the world. And I think it's important. There's been great, I love book Beasts in the Field. There's been great production. But it's limited relative to other things within the academy. And so the consequence of that is we have an inferior or a less comprehensive understanding of a discipline because there's not enough people working on it because there's status rewards. So that's what I was getting at the question, if that makes sense.
No, I see where you're coming from, Jordan. And when I landed on this topic as a graduate student for a dissertation prospectus, I was shocked that there wasn't more written on wine.
Yeah.
It's a major industry in California, and people have handled it and they've done a beautiful job, but it's not gotten the same attention. So I see where you're coming from.
Okay, let's go ahead and jump into some of the questions. Early narratives of agricultural history in California were very triumphalist. We can look back at kind of those early boosters, essentially writing about California and wanting to boost ag, which was after the gold rush, the major industry. So how did those early writings portray farmers and laborers in California?
Those that body of booster literature from the mid to late 19th century, early 20th century is absolutely fascinating to me.
Yeah.
They portrayed agriculture, including viticulture, as this promising up and coming industry where it was almost like a second gold rush, the way it was portrayed. The language in these pamphlets that they would mail to Eastern and Midwestern states were so optimistic. Yeah. There's plentiful land. It's cheap. There's scientific research happening here. You can have a farm and make ample income for your family. And the other part of this literature that fascinated me is that these farmers and early trade organizations, including the California State Agricultural Society, were inviting competition, right? They were encouraging migrants to come to California and set up shop essentially in the field next to theirs and produce crops alongside them that would essentially compete with them on the market. So I was puzzled by that. You know, what's going on there?
Yeah. So we have this kind of triumphal period, and then we have a turn in the 20th century. I don't know where you'd make that demarcation. You brought up Carey McWilliams. That's a made Factories in the Field was a major kind of landmark piece or monograph on a kind of a changing perspective. But that was already in the works, that kind of altered perspective. Where would you pinpoint this kind of turn towards looking at it in the labor lens? And what do you think caused that? Was that Great Depression related? Like, where can we pinpoint? I'm also working on a John Steinbeck series for this podcast, and we're reading In Dubious Battle right now, which is like labor and strike narrative, the kind of anatomy of a strike, if you will. And so I'm just curious, like, where you see that inflection point where it turns a little bit?
Yeah, I think that the attention to the condition, the labor conditions of ag workers is definitely a Great Depression shift. But I think that the decline of the industry happened a little earlier, right after World War I. This is true with the viticultural industry and wine industry in California, but it's true across the country in American history. American farmers during World War I had increased their production pretty dramatically.
Yeah.
To help meet the needs of European populations, right? Their farmlands were decimated. And they needed to feed people. So American farmers expanded their production in the 19-teens. And they were able to do due to the demand in the markets. But also there was a lot of scientific innovation in the 19-aughts and 19-teens. A lot more mechanization, improvements in chemical fertilizers, all of this stuff that enabled them to ramp up production really quickly. And it made their production more profitable. They needed less labor. And then World War I ended, and that market demand in Europe went away. So American farmers felt a change, right, in their market conditions far earlier. And we had earlier hints of environmental change related to the Dust Bowl as well that started to be that overproduction, over-fertilization, destruction of topsoil, all of that. It happened in the 1920s. So a little earlier than the Great Depression. But from a labor perspective, I don't think that Americans, if we look at the historiography, there's not that attention to workers until the Great Depression.
Yeah. Where do you think you diverge most starkly with Carey McWilliams' writing? I understand he's more journalistic in his approach versus academic, but do you feel like you are... some of your understandings of labor align and there are points where you diverge?
I think that I diverge with him a lot in some ways it feels like a bit of an unfair comparison. He's writing almost 100 years ago.
Right. Yeah.
I look at racialization a lot, and he saw workers, I think, more from the lens of class, right? That class solidarity. And it's not completely fair because he did incredible work in looking at Mexican immigrants in California and their plight and their experiences. And that was so groundbreaking for the time. He was doing that so early on with a very honest and critical lens. But I think that I'm a product of my time, as was Carey McWilliams. And I was trained by people who look at race in a somewhat relational way, and understand that citizenship and race is a social construction right of its time, and that these groups, these labor groups, were put against each other to determine hierarchies and their place in society.
Yeah, there's obviously the element of presentism here. And I understand, like, people are located in historical contexts. I was just curious for you to reflect. And yeah, I think that is an important missing dimension there. Let's jump to the kind of the arrival of labor history in the kind of 60s through the 80s. How did that change the discussion of agriculture once we brought in the labor component? This coincides with a lot of labor movements as well. So can you talk about that change and how dramatic it was in understanding agriculture through another lens?
Yeah. I feel like I can't talk about this without considering the UFW and the great picker strikes of the late 60s and early 70s. I think that for the field of history, but especially for Chicano history, with which I engage, that really brought the labor conditions of farm workers in California, but across the Southwest, migrant farm workers, that brought it to the forefront and made it a field of study that could not be ignored. So I really situate the UFW and the rise of Chavez and Dolores Huerta and Larry Itliong as people in that contemporary space who forced the academy and historians and ethnic studies to look critically at the experiences of farm workers.
Yeah. Have you engaged in, I know this is touched on throughout your book, and I'm curious for you to talk about, what has environmental history contributed to this discussion, ecological perspectives and how they intersect with capitalism and agribusiness? Like, how has that informed you and how you look at it, that kind of ecological or environmental dimension?
Yeah. And this is one of those areas where, you know, in all graduate students who will write a book will know that there's always something you wish you could have done more with the book.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, a valid critique of my book. I did not engage a lot with environmental change. There's always something more we could do.
You can't do everything in a monograph.
If I were to write part two of this book, or if someone were to say, there's a gap here, this would be one that I would be thrilled. If another scholar came in and wrote an environmental history of California wine or California wine alongside citrus, and maybe included a little bit of food studies in there too, I think that would be an incredible contribution to the field. But in terms of what I did with environmental history, I did look at the migration, the movement, importation of plants. Right? That's a huge part of the history of California wine, the introduction of new foreign grape varietals and what that meant for the local environment and the production of wine. And then I do touch a little bit on new technologies and how that shaped the treatment of the land and changing land use. But if anyone is listening and wants to do an environmental history, I am here for it. A true environmental history. I think that would be amazing.
Yeah, kind of a Bill Cronin style, changes in the land. Absolutely. I think that would be fantastic. You've anticipated my next question, which was like gaps where future scholarship should investigate. So let's go ahead and jump to your book. How would you classify where Grapes of Conquest fits within this broader historiographical conversation that we've been having? What did you hope it would add to the discussion?
I love this question because anytime I'm at a social gathering, not with scholars, someone will say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a historian. Oh, what do you write on? What do you research? And we talk about my book. And the assumption is always that I must be a wine expert who has a wine collection.
You're a sommelier, of course.
I know everything there is to know about wine. And my book is a book that uses California wine and the wine industry to understand race and conquest and changing land use in California. Wine is the element with which I look at those changes in 19th century California. So I really see this book as a story of how conquest and race making played out in California across Spanish, Mexican, and American California. It's not really about just wine. It's not a wine history.
Yeah. Well, we all have to have a vehicle, right? Like the way I've started when I'm looking at a new area that I want to understand is I like going through art history and looking at the creation and production of art as a kind of mechanism pathway. And I think that's true with really any discipline. There's always some kind of, you're not above something where you're looking in. You always have to, your feet have to be somewhere, if you will. So let's jump to your introduction. In the introduction, you say that the early wine industry is a significant missing piece of California history. And this kind of touches on a subject we were discussing, which is place and status and knowledge production. Why do you think it's been missing?
Yeah, that is such a good question. I see this arc, this narrative arc that we understand about land use in California. We have native land use, which has also been marginalized up until relatively recently. And the traditional narrative is there were native peoples, and then the missions came, right? The Spanish used the land for missions, and then we had ranching, cattle ranching, and then there was gold rush. And there's been there's been discussion of wheat farming. And then all of a sudden, we jump from the 1850s, 1860s, discussions of wheat, construction of the railroad, and all of a sudden, we're in the late 19th century, and there's bountiful citrus. And I wonder why there was this gap. And it could be what you alluded to earlier about lack of interest, lack of respect, I don't know, for ag studies. I think they've fallen out of favor. It's just not a topic that's been sexy in the last 25 years. Ag history, something that maybe older historians do. And it's not there because there's been incredible work the last 25 years.
Absolutely.
Looking at agriculture, and perhaps there's been less engagement between history and ethnic studies, historians who have looked at agriculture and labor and race.
I want to dig further into your introduction now. At one point in the introduction, you refer to wine producers as cultural producers. And I'm going to quote here. You say, quote, wine growers changed understandings of what it meant to belong in California and what it meant to own and use land. Can you explicate that a little further, the assumptions there, and maybe explain what you mean by cultural producers? I like to, early on in these kind of conversations, I like to unpack like the mechanisms we're going to try to understand the historical period. And so I'd love for you to explain what you mean there in terms of those words.
These wine growers, is when I refer to them in the book, were not just growing and manufacturing a food product. What I saw in the archive and what I argue is that they did a lot of work in framing a narrative around the cultural and social value of the product they were producing. And what I mean by this, I think, let me step back, actually. It helps to contextualize the period a bit, right? They were not just producing grape jelly or grape juice. They were producing an alcoholic product in the middle to late 19th century at a time when the prohibition movement was gathering steam, the temperance movement. So they had a couple of challenges with their product. One, they had to confront the very real threat of middle-class white Anglo women who were arguing that alcohol was a social vice and was dangerous to women, children, and families. And then second, they had to confront a national landscape that looked askance at California and the West. There was, in the middle of the 19th century, this idea that it was an American state, but there were questions as to whether it was truly an American place. Was it still this backwards Spanish, Mexican, Catholic place? So there are religious concerns circulating about. There are social concerns. So to mitigate and address those, they had to control the narrative and market what California wine really was.
Interesting. Let's continue on. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Indigenous communities. That's what you cover in your first chapter. And we've done extensive conversations on this podcast about the mission period of California because it's so instrumental in so many things. And kids are often taught these canards in their fourth grade classes about how things worked. And I've worked hard to try to explore those, unpack those, where they come from. How is it a tool of power to teach narratives that tend to whitewash history? And I'm curious for you, because you mentioned that wine and wine production on missions was an instrument of power and control. I also like conversations where we talk about, in the Dr. Hurtado fashion, about survival and adaptation and different ways that Indigenous people took these things and adapted them to their own uses. Is there things that Indigenous people in your research took from wine and adapted for their own purposes that you could talk about? I'd be curious if you have some knowledge in that domain.
Yeah. I think that if we're looking at the mission period itself, as well as the Mexican period, there are documented instances of Native Californians using wine or winemaking paraphernalia or even grapes, right, to resist authority. And that looked like things such as stealing winemaking equipment, stealing grapes. At one point, they were prohibited from owning anything related to winemaking, to grapes, to any kind of alcohol. And there were instances in the records, in the mission records mostly, where I found Native peoples stealing these or owning them in direct defiance of the law, either for their own personal use, but more often to sell, to produce and to sell. And then on the other hand, there are instances of, and you mentioned this already, but it being a tool of control and coercion. And I saw that too, especially in the missions, Native peoples finding ways to steal alcohol for intoxication. Those were incredibly sad stories.
Yeah. Yeah. When you think and conceptualize these Franciscan priests that were operating these missions, do you, in your research, do you see their use of wine as an instrument of control? Do you see that as something with clear intent, or do you see it as a broader tool of empire, of Spanish empire, it's the miasma that they breathe? It's just something that they're doing? Or I'm trying to understand, like, is it a twisting mustache kind of plot, or is it something that is just a tragic period of well-intentioned people? We have this discussion a lot about the Uniprocera and like how to look at these folks. And I'm curious your kind of perspective. It's a little bit of a philosophical question, less of a historical question, but I'm curious for you to reflect on that.
So when I look at this and you use tool of imperial control, yes and no. So in the case of the Franciscans, wine was sacramental. It was a table wine for their own table, for their own consumption. But in the case of Native Californians, they saw it as an absolutely crucial item that they needed to have access to constantly in order to say the Mass. If they did not have sacramental wine, they could not say the Mass. They could not demonstrate transubstantiation to California Natives, and they could not convert them. And that was their primary goal. That was their primary goal. Now, that said, we can't separate them from the Spanish Empire. Missionization was an absolutely crucial tool of conquest and imperialism for the Spanish. It was the key arm, right, that made their control of Alta California possible. Without that team of Franciscan missionaries, they could not have done it with the number of soldiers that they had. So you can't separate it, in my opinion.
Yeah. Let's jump a little further along here. There were two sections in your book that were particularly fascinating because there were major moments or major institutions in California wine history that I was less familiar with. The Agricultural Society, and the Anaheim wine colony. I want to start, there's fascinating things. Let's start with the first one, this agricultural society. It was a kind of a formalization or kind of a quasi-professionalization of some aspects of agriculture, but it did a lot of harm in terms of just broad erasure of labor from the history or the story. Can you talk about the function of the agricultural society, why it was created, and what were, in broad strokes, its effects on viticulture?
Wow. It's a society that not many people have written about, but very important in California history, in my opinion. It's founded in the early 1850s, so soon after statehood. And what I found interesting is that the state funded it. This was a time, and there was a lot of cash from the gold rush, but they prioritized it enough to provide it with an annual stipend. They sent representatives of the State Agricultural Society all up and down California to visit different farms and write reports, and they distributed these across the state and even across the nation. So this was something that the state government took seriously. But your broader question was about
the effects,
the harm, the effects of it. I think that it really served to signal to farmers, to the farming community across the country, that agriculture was a serious venture in California. This society advocated for the creation of a college of agriculture in California. They are the ones who lobbied extensively to create that arm of the University of California. There were debates. Should this be a college of letters and arts, or should it be a true land-grant college with more technical programs? And in the end, the UC was more of a college of letters and arts, but they got a college of agriculture. They got funding to support the creation of agricultural research stations all up and down the state, some of which are still here. And in fact, UC Davis's roots are in an agricultural station that was part of the UC in the 1850s. So I see that as a huge consequence. They were instrumental in bringing experts. They would write to experts in Missouri, in New York, in Virginia, places where there were, in the case of viticulture, where there were experts on grape growing, and they would correspond and distribute that information. So it was a way to signal that California as a state was taking agriculture very seriously and that it was a scientific and professional venture.
Let's talk about the Anaheim Wine Colony now. It's such an interesting story. I've done a fair amount of research on agricultural history in the Central Valley because that's where I live and I'm broadly from. But I was less familiar with the Anaheim Wine Colony. Can you tell the story for people of what this really interesting organization was? It's a cooperative organization. I think German immigrants came over and wanted to create something. What were, in a similar way to our question about agricultural society, if you could tell the story, and then what were its effects on viticulture?
Yeah. So this is it's one of those histories that makes you scratch your head a little bit and say history is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
I want to back up a little bit. I started this book thinking I was going to write about Napa and Sonoma and Chinese wine workers there in the late 19th century. But when I started researching, I realized that the industry began far earlier in the missions, but the heart of the commercial industry was in the Los Angeles area. And that blew my mind. So as I started investigating, I came across this history of Germans who started a wine cooperative in Anaheim. And early historians of California, early Euro-American Anglo historians had touched on this with more booster histories in the 1940s, maybe 50s. There's a few articles if you dig in California history, like you can find these, and they're really interesting. But here's the story. So after the gold rush, there was a community of German immigrants living in San Francisco. And according to lore, they hatched a plan that the two musicians, Kohler and Froling, who were making their living with the fiddle in German communities up in San Francisco were on their way to have lunch at the Cliff House, and they stumbled across some grapes, and it occurred to them that these grapes would make great wine. And this is, again, this is what legend says. So at that moment, they decided to hatch this plan to grow grapes and begin producing wine. Okay. So they helped organize this wine cooperative, and they collaborated with a Los Angeles surveyor, a man named George Hansen, to help them locate a suitable plot of land in Southern California, because that was the heart of the wine industry at the time. It was not San Francisco. It's not that area. So George Hansen had surveyed a lot of Los Angeles County for the land cases, the Mexican land grant cases. So he was very familiar with the best plots of land. And he came across this land that was being sold by a Mexican California, Ontiveros was his name, in what is now Orange County, though at the time it was LA County. And it was adjacent to the Santa Ana River. And this group of German colonists, that's what they called themselves, who had all pitched in to own property cooperatively, bought the land. They paid George Hansen to develop it. So Hansen hired, he hired Mexican and Indian and Chinese workers, and they are the ones who laid out the land, the laid out plots to set up a town in the middle of Mexican California. Essentially, their neighbors were all Mexican California ranchers. They are the ones who planted the vineyards. They fenced it completely to protect it from cattle. And once the land was established and the town was built, then the German colonists came down and moved in and started farming. So what I found fascinating about this history is if you look at Boucher histories about Anaheim, later generations of residents of Anaheim would look at this and applaud their plucky pioneer founders, town founders. But the reality is that they didn't actually engage with pretty much any of the hard work of constructing a town from scratch, clearing land, planting vineyards, any of that work. They came once it was already established.
Yeah, the mythology there. I could dig further into this, but we're going to take the 20,000 perspective on California history. I'm curious, what do you think would be the response if you slid your book across the table to one of the big wine growers in California? If you read wine publications that come out, obviously it's a business, so they're trying to operate and market as such. How do you think they would receive your research and your book based on your understanding of where wine is? Do you think they would disagree with the history, or do you think they would remake it? I know, because I often go to wine country, that there's a sense of taking ownership of some of the harms that have been done. You see this in some of the materials that you'll get at some wineries. Some wineries, obviously, the goal is not to revisit those darker parts of the history, but some are taking some ownership. So I'm curious broadly how you think it would be received, or if you've gotten feedback from the wine industry.
So I've not gotten feedback from the wine industry. And it's interesting. I gave a talk when the book first came out to the Sonoma Valley Historical Society, and I expected some pushback.
Yeah. And
actually, the members of that group were very receptive. They actually gave me tips for further research, people to look into, winemakers of color. So it was a really beautiful and inspiring conversation. But to answer your question directly, I think it would depend on who I asked.
Yeah.
Let me start with the first community I want to talk about. In recent years, there has been a growth of Mexican-American winemakers in Napa, Sonoma, and the Central Coast, and they've organized, they have a trade group. I think if I were to go to them and hand them my book, I think they would be thrilled.
Yeah.
Because they celebrate their cultural roots, their immigrant roots. It is part of their marketing. If you go to a Robledo or say Ceja Wine, it is part of their brand.
Yeah.
And I think they would love this. That said, there is a lot of romanticism and mythology around Italian Americans being the founders of the California wine industry. And I don't want to diminish the labor and the influence of Italian Americans on the 20th century wine industry, especially on its growth after World War II.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's fair to say that Italian Americans founded the California wine industry. And on that, I think I would get some pushback. I think it was a multiracial effort. Germans, Chinese, Native peoples, Mexican Californios. It was really diverse. And the other thing I want to say is that my book really challenges some of the hero myths around the California wine industry. And the person that comes to mind is Agustin Horazti, whose winery, Buena Vista Winery, is still around today. It goes by BV, right? You can buy it in the grocery store. I've been to his winery. And there is still this idea that he was and is the father of California wine, even though that is something that Thomas Pinney debunked years ago with his History of Wine in America, that two-volume book that's incredibly researched. And he has a chapter on Horazti and poses the question directly, was he really the founder of California wine, the modern wine industry? And he does this meticulous overview of Horazti's life. And in the end, the answer is, well, no, not really. So I do think that it deflates the balloon a little bit around some of those pioneer mythologies.
Yeah. Yeah. I think and I experience that in local history a lot when I do stuff with historical societies. And it's often financial, who's paying for things to be written. And in the wine industry world, so much of wine, because I've been to Napa and spent $100 on a bottle, so much of it is story, right? And so it's so important that we have a lot of different lenses, and some characters that have been marginalized or sidelined get recentered in these conversations. I tend to ask everyone that I talk with, we talked about where you place your feet, but now I want to lift you up and let you look at the landscape here. How has this research you've done on the history of viticulture and the wine industry, how has that changed your perspective on California and the history of California more broadly? How has this kind of altered or enriched your perspective or challenged some assumptions you had?
When I started this, at the top of our conversation, I mentioned that I really came into my work as a historian, thinking that I would focus on Mexican American and Mexican immigrant populations. And in the history of the 20th century, they're absolutely one of the big groups, and alongside Filipino migrants, Chinese, Japanese, people who really built up California ag. But this book and this research that began as a dissertation really forced me to go backwards a lot and to explore the history of land use and labor through multifaceted immigrant groups that I was not at all expecting to be players in this history. I thought this would be a history of Mexican Californios and Chinese workers. And what I found was completely different. I had to really integrate Euro-American immigrants, Euro-European immigrants and Euro-Americans into this history. And that was not something I was expecting. I was not expecting Germans to be the characters in this book or in the history of Californian wine. I thought Italian Americans would be, but that's not what I found. It's not what the archive revealed to me.
Wow. We conclude these podcasts each time with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend either about these subjects or subjects that interest you? We mentioned a couple to start here, and I'm curious if there are others that come to mind if people are looking to enrich their understanding of California history, but also wine history as well.
Okay, so I'm going to give you two books that were literally on my shelf that I've been thinking about a lot.
Okay.
One is a wine history and the other one is a California history. And they're wildly different. So the first is Imperial Wine by Jennifer Reagan Lefebvre. Not sure if I pronounced that correctly, but she's faculty at Trinity College. This is the book here.
Okay.
And it is a book actually about the British Empire and wine. And it is an absolutely fascinating book about the cultural, political, imperial significance of wine. So I, for people who are interested in alcohol histories, imperial histories, race, this is an amazing book. I highly recommend you pick it up. It's published by the press.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, relatively new, a couple years old. The other book takes us into the 20th century, 19th century urban history. And it is Hello Town.
Ah, previous guest of the show. Yeah, fantastic.
By Mitchell Schwarzer. Sure.
Yeah.
And we were talking about earlier histories of California that have been marginalized or overlooked. And I think that the history of Oakland and the East Bay is sorely understudied. And this book was riveting. I couldn't put it down. Fills gaps in the field and is just a general delight to read. Incredibly readable. I think it could have been a trade book. It's amazing. Also press. So.
Well, last question for you. What are you working on next?
So I thought Wine and I were done. I was like, oh, we've been together a long time. It's time for us to break up.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'm done with wine. I don't think I'm done. So what I'm working on right now is two things. One, an article on the Fountain Grove Winery in Santa Rosa, which was also a cooperative colony wine situation in the late 19th, early 20th century. And I'm interested in that aspect. But I'm also interested in the fact that it was organized and run by a Japanese-American winemaker. So I'm wanting to look more into that. And then the second part is almost like a part two of this book, but again, focused on labor, possibly a little bit more food studies element. But I want to know more about, and I want to complicate our understanding as to how California wine became an international brand after World War II. Again, we have this beautiful story of immigrants from Italy in San Francisco who moved to the Napa and Sonoma valleys after World War II and began producing wines. And it was this quiet industry for a couple of decades, and it took off all of a sudden in the 1970s. But I want to know more about what was happening behind the scenes there. And it's a very new project. I'm faculty in the CSU. We teach a lot. So I've not had as much time to get into it, but that's where I'm poking around these days.
Fantastic. Again, the title of the book is The Grapes of Conquest, Race, Labor, and the Industrialization of California Wine. Dr. Ornelas Higdon, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.